going to start discussing Rav Nachum Zembo with a quote by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal. This is from Leaves of Faith, article entitled The Future of Centrist Orthodoxy. A little bit out of context, you'll figure out what he's trying to say and how it relates to Rav Nachum Zembo shortly. The failure to monitor the inevitable fallout is serious. Far more grievous, however, is the existence of a weakness that logically does not inhere in the centrist outlook and sociologically need not flow from it. What in the quest for scope mandates, for example, that children in a Mamlachti Dati school in Jerusalem should go home at noon, while their peers in a cheder learn till evening? What degree of historical sensitivity dictates that a Haredi of high school age makes do with 3 weeks summer vacation, while his modern counterpart has well over 2 months? Does a universalist concern require that youngsters, and hence most adults as well, know a good deal about the Rolling Stones, but nothing of the Avnei Nezer? That they be familiar with batting averages, but unable to identify Reb Menachem Zembo? Okay, so it's very important, apparently, that you be able to identify Reb Menachem Zembo. On that note, Menachem Zembo, 1883-1943, was born in Prague. His father, Elazar, died when he was a young boy, so he was brought out by his grandfather, Rabbi Avram Zembo. Rabbi Avram was a chassid of the Kutzker Rebbe, and he was a student of the Chidushi Harim, and was now a follower of the Sfas Emes of Gur. So Rav Zembo was brought up in the Ger Chassidut by his grandfather, and he remained a loyal chassid his whole life. Even years later, when he eventually became a Torah scholar, or a posek, and leader of Chassidut himself, he still considered himself a simple chassid of the Rebbe of Ger. So when he visited Ger, he was called by his first name, and he wouldn't sit at the Rebbe's table. He just sat with the with the rest of the chassidim. At 18, he married the daughter of a wealthy local merchant, which meant that he didn't have to go earn a living, and he was able to dedicate himself to study Torah. He was able to learn Torah unhindered for the next 20 years, and in his writings, some of which we have, he remembered them as the happiest years of his life. When his father-in-law died, he had to help out in the store that his father-in-law had that supported him. So then he started working. So at this point, everybody said to him, "Why are you doing working, earning a living this way? Let's hire you to be the rabbi of this town or that town." And he had a lot of offers. But he said, "Working and learning on the side gives me more time to learn than being a community rabbi." Okay, the same idea expressed two different ways, though. Probably related. Fine. In 1935, together with two other Rabbanim, Rav Yaakov Meir Biederman, the brother-in-law of the Ger Rebbe, Rabbi Avram Weinberg, they were appointed as the Rabbanut of Warsaw. So he became a posek, and he started answering questions from all around the world, especially all around Poland. And he was very active in the Agudas Yisrael. They had a kenis, a big convention, with all the Gdolim. There were three of them before the Holocaust. In the first one he attended, he was a secretary. In the second one, Rav Chaim Ozer, who was supposed to head it, insisted that he would come only if, again, Rav Zembo would be the secretary. In the third one, he was a speaker. And the reports that we have, there are many reports of it, that he spoke to a hushed crowd in awe. So he was still a young Rav, but somehow he was making his impression. When World War II broke out, so German invaded Poland, so he became a very important force in the work at Warsaw Ghetto. It's a source of hope, inspiration, optimism. He set up secret places to study Torah, and constantly, at great personal risk, would visit these places to give a shir here, to be mechazik them there. His wife died in the ghetto, and there's actually a few stories, at least two times that we know about, that he was offered an escape from the ghetto. One of them, there was a family, a very wealthy family in Switzerland, named the Sternbach family. They rescued many, many, many Jews, and they were known as a place of refuge for a lot of people who managed to escape. Just get to the Sternbachs, everything will be okay. So at a certain point, he was given a a passport from Costa Rica that they arranged in his name, but apparently there was a misspelling. It spelled it as Ziember instead of Ziemba, so it didn't work. And another time, all of a sudden, he was summoned to the internet along with two other Rabbanim, Rav David Shapiro and Rav Shimon Stochamer, and they told them that the Catholic Church was willing to rescue them. The three of them refused to go, saying, if we go, all the other Jews are going to start to despair. They're going to have Yeush. We have to stay here to support them. Even though people generally didn't meet a Rav because there weren't as many Shilas because you didn't have those luxuries. One of the things he did was he made a committee that was going to provide Pesach supplies for the ghetto. And he was in constant surveillance by the authorities because of this. So he couldn't become personally involved with the underground, but whenever money was needed, so he was like one of the first to donate. Donated money for ammunition, etc. And he gave his bracha, he was the spiritual force behind it. So the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising happened soon after Pesach, or soon after Seder night. And Pesach, Rav Nechemiah is going to talk in a minute about his last Seder, but I'm just going to end the story here. But he prepared himself for the holiday and everything is going on, all the fighting around him. He had the Seder as though times were normal. But he spent the next few days in hideouts while the ghetto was being burnt. And the Nazis were methodically destroying the ghetto, burning building by building. And, you know, if this place was suspected by being part of the uprising, they would burn it down and they'd go building to building. So one of those buildings they burnt, I hope I pronounced the street name right, was Kupieka or Kupiecha 7. Which included in that complex the building where he was holed up. So now there's a fire, and he can't get out because in the street are Germans with machine guns. Some people tried to run across and, of course, were shot. There was a momentary lull in the shooting, and his daughter ran out and made it across the street. And there were reports that she did something with her arm that they interpreted as Kamu was safe and was probably stay, it's not safe. So he, believing it was safe, ran out, and he himself was gunned down, including while he was holding one of his grandsons, Yankel Ber. So many of them were killed trying to escape the fire that was going to kill them anyway. He's actually buried on Har Menuchot. It was in 1958 when certain people in the Israeli government discovered that they were going to raise a cemetery and rebuild that area. So they arranged to have his body flown. And there he was given a proper kavura with a large funeral fitting for a Talmud Chacham of his stature, about 10,000 people. I want to just say one quote, and with that I'll end, and Rav Nechemiah will discuss this Seder night. In the cholera. Okay. One quote, he said, in the past, during religious persecution, we were required by the law to give up our lives, even for the least essential practice. In the present, however, when we are faced with an arch enemy whose unparalleled ruthlessness and program of total annihilation knew no bounds, halacha demands that we fight and resist to the very end with unequal determination and valor for the sake of the sanctification of the divine name. So there's machloket over how involved he was in the uprising. He was certainly the religious visionary behind it, whether or not he actively supported it, but he was saying that many of the ideas we have in halakha about dying al kiddush Hashem, some of those were willing to view them not as the lechachila or only lechachila. It's a possibility that this uprising is a proper halachic path, and certainly this quote leads one to conclude that he was behind that. On that note, satma yesh lo si.
מהתיאורים שמתארים את רבי מנחם זמבה, לצערנו, מה שנשאר לנו מהתורה שלו זה מעט מאוד. יש ספר שנקרא תוצאות חיים. תוצאות חיים, רבי מנחם כתב לזכר החותן שלו, שפרנס אותו במשך 20 שנה. כשהחותן שלו נפטר, אז לזכרו הוא כתב את הספר הזה, ספר קטן על ענייני הוצאה בשבת, אבל ספר מאוד חשוב, משתמשים בו הרבה בישיבות. חוץ מזה, יש לו חיבור על כל הרמב״ם. היה לו חיבורים, היה לו משהו כמו 1,000 דפים כתובים שכולם היו אצלו בבית והכל נשרף. מה ממש הצליחו ללקט מתוך כל מיני מאמרים שהוא פרסם בכתבי עת וכל מיני דברים שהוא כתב והתפרסמו במקומות אחרים, כינסו את זה לספר אחד שנקרא חידושי רבי מנחם זמבה, אבל חוץ מזה כל התורה שלו בעצם חבל על דאבדין. מה שמתארים רבי מנחם זמבה, שהוא היה חד בדרה, הוא היה שילוב מאוד מיוחד, הוא היה אדם קודם כל ברמה האנושית, אדם מאוד מאוד שמח, מחייך. יש לי תמונה שלו, יש לך תמונה שלו? אין הרבה תמונות, אבל בכל התמונות שאני ראיתי תמיד הוא מחייך. אדם מלא בשמחה, שמחת חיים. היה נמוך, 1.60 מטר.
It's 4.5 feet.
בכל השנים שהוא היה בפראגה, הוא יושב ולמד. זה היה אותו בניין שבו היה העסק של החותן שלו, וקומה מעל זה הוא יושב ולמד. והוא לא התפרסם, לא היה לו שום משרה, אבל כל הגדולים שהגיעו פה לאזור, כולם היו צריכים לבקר אצל רבי מנחם זמבה. והיה לו קשר עם כל הגדולים. עם האור שמח, עם רבי יוסף אנגין, עם הרוגצ'ובר. הרוגצ'ובר שהיה מכסח את כולם, כיבד אותו מאוד, כן? ויש סיפור שהם נפגשו פעם, ורבי מנחם זמבה הקשה לו קושייה, ולא היה לו תירוץ. וזה כמעט לא קורה אצל רוגצ'ובר שמקשים לו קושייה ואין לו תירוץ. אבל אחרי הרבה הרבה שנים הם נפגשו שוב, נדמה לי שהרוגצ'ובר כבר היה חולה, ורבי מנחם בא לבקר אותו, ואז אמר לו, מצאתי תירוץ לקושייה שלך מלפני כמה עשרות שנים. אז זה היה מין מקום של עלייה לרגל. כל מי שהגיע לאזור בא לדבר איתו בלימוד. והוא הכניס את כולם ודיבר עם כולם וקיבל את כולם בסבר פנים יפות. גם בחינת השיטת לימוד שלו, אז הוא היה חסיד גור. והלמדנות הפולנית היא הייתה אחרת, היא הייתה שונה. ולכן הרבה פעמים הייתה קצת עוינות, היה קצת מתיחות בין הליטא לבין פולין, והגדולים של אלה לא כל כך מה החסיד מבין ברמב"ם, הוא לא יודע בכלל ללמוד. אבל רבי מנחם זמבה כולם העריכו אותו בגלל שהיה לו שילוב מאוד מאוד מיוחד של הרב קשר כתב עליו, שהיה לו את עושה רשימה שלמה עם שישה גדולים. הוא היה חריף כמו זה רבי יצחק אלחונון, זה כמו האור שמח, זה ומחדש כמו רבי יוסף אנגין. היה בו משהו מאוד מאוד מחדש ומאוד מתוק ומאוד משהו מאוד ככה משלב ומיוחד, וכולם אהבו אותו, כולם קיבלו אותו, כיבדו אותו. כבר מגיל 30 התייחסו אליו כגדול, כאילו היה באמת חד בדרה. נפטר לפני גיל 60 ולא זכינו לתורתו, חבל על ידי אבדין. כשאני מנסה ככה לדמיין את הדמות הזאת, דמות של חסיד עם חיוך גדול ולמדנות מתוקה, אז זה בטח משהו בבואה של זה, יש לנו ברבי אושר וייס, אבל קחו דבר כזה בעוצמה של רבי מנחם זמבה, אפשר לקבל אולי מושג על מה מדובר, על איזה דמות. היה לו גם את הצד של החסידות שלו, של התורות שהוא, לא היה לו חצר. הוא רק להיות, גם להיות רב הוא לא רצה. רק אחרי שלא הייתה לו ברירה, אז הוא נהיה רב של ורשה. אבל הוא נתן פה ושם דרשות, אבל עם רעיונות חסידיים. נקודה אחת רק, אמרת שהוא עמד בטיש של האדמו"ר, מגור, אז זה היה ככה עד שהגיע רבי חיל מאוסטרובצה. והוא הגיע לטיש של הרבי מגור, הוא אומר לו, מנחם עומד? איך יכול להיות? ומאז הרבי אמר שהוא צריך לשבת